Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today we'll hear a presentation by Nebraska State Senator Kathy Campbell, Chairwoman of the Health and Human Services Committee of the Nebraska Unicameral, and Carolyn Rooker, Executive Director of Voices for Children in Nebraska. They'll speak on the topic, Child Welfare in Nebraska, Some Big Changes. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, May 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
The Nebraska legislature this year made some major changes in the way the state deals with the safety and well-being of abused and neglected children in the state. There was a consensus that the system as it existed simply was not working. Those changes and how they are intended to make a difference is the subject of our noon forum today. We have two people here today to talk about it, State Senator Kathy Campbell of Lincoln, Chairwoman of the Health and Human Services Committee, guided the legislation through the unicameral, Carolyn Rooker, Executive Director of Voices for Children in Nebraska, is an advocate on child welfare issues. They're going to talk about the changes for about a half an hour, and then we will take your questions. There is paper and pencil at your table. Write down your questions, and they will be brought to me to ask from the podium when we begin, when we get to that point. So we're going to begin with Senator Campbell. Senator?
Good afternoon. I want to thank the Omaha Press Club for the opportunity to come visit with you today, and it's particularly nice to see a number of familiar faces in the audience, many of whom could probably give the remarks that Carolyn and I are going to give today, but it's awfully nice to see some of our colleagues in the child welfare area here. I'm going to give you the background to the bills, and then Carolyn's going to talk a little bit about the implications and the future. And one of the things I always like to start out with is somewhat of a very broad definition in terms of child welfare. And generally, we think of the kids who are in child welfare as those who have been abused and neglected, and also some of the kids who may have a crossover path from juvenile justice. And the privatization and partnership, privatization of child welfare services goes back a very long time. Basically preceded government's involvement, the turn of the century, actually the first noted agency that dealt and pronounced and said we need to look at child abuse was the American Humane Society. Government then gradually became involved in this field. The system that we now have in Nebraska is fairly complex. It deals with the fact that the law requires every citizen in the state of Nebraska to report child abuse and neglect to law enforcement or state hotline. And then only a law enforcement can remove a child from the home. The Department of Health and Human Services does a report, gives that report to the judiciary, and the judge determines if the child should return home or be taken from the home to another setting while a plan for the child is put together. The department then puts together that plan, and the judge monitors what happens with that child. As Gary indicated, in 2009, Nebraska embarked upon a new initiative, a privatization effort that dealt with what we will call the lead agency model. And I believe that two major factors drove this initiative from the beginning. Why did we get into the initiative? One was the high numbers that Nebraska has had over the course of years for out-of-home placement of children, one of the highest in the nation. And number two, that there's a sense that the private sector could do it better with perhaps more flexibility and adaptability. The story of the child welfare reform effort started in 2009, and do we have any English majors in the audience today? Oh, good. I taught English in high school, And that's how I started out. And so I often taught the Robert Frost program, or poem, Any Road Taken. But for Nebraska Child Welfare in 2009, it's better that we think of the Yogi Berra quote, "If you come to a fork in the road, take it," which is exactly what the state did. It started out on its lead agency model with six lead agencies, which would have the responsibility for the coordination of services and either could provide the services or subcontract. And I want to briefly tell you about the progression of those six, because the initiative was molded around those six. One of the six didn't even start with the initiative, did not sign the contract, and felt that they could not financially make it. By April of 2010, the second agency indicated that it would finish out the first-year contract but not renew or continue. The third agency filed bankruptcy papers in April that same month, and the state and another lead agency immediately took over the care of children. By August of 2010, number four agency terminated the contract by mutual agreement, but numbers of subcontractors were left with money owed to them. And by December of 2010, the remaining two lead agencies indicated that they could not take or continue their work unless two things happened, as they needed more money to make this effort work, and they also wanted to undertake the case management. So the state interjected $25 million to the two agencies, and as well as giving them case management, and eventually put in another $5.5 million. So by January of 2011, when the legislature convened, there were problems all across the system, and they were noted quite admirably by a number of state advocates, of course, one of those being a strong voice from Voices for Children. The legislature introduced LR 37, calling for an investigation by the Health and Human Services Committee of the Child Welfare Privatization Initiative. And I have to say that we were greatly aided in that year-long investigation and review by eight public and private departments and agencies who became the collaborators in this report. And they came forward to help with the investigation. And I'm going to briefly mention them because then you can see the breadth of the interest in this topic. The state auditor, the legislature's performance audit committee and staff, the legislature's budget and fiscal office, and Liz is here today and can answer any questions probably from that end. The legislative ombudsman's office, the state Supreme Court and their court improvement project, the foster care review board, Appleseed, and of course, Voices for Children. The committee undertook hundreds of interviews with individuals, emails, and letters, and conducted five public hearings from Scotts Bluff to Omaha, gathering information about this initiative and what was working and what was not. On December the 15th of last year, the committee released a 425-page report and made 18 recommendations and presented 9 bills, which eventually were consolidated into 5 major bills, all of which passed, were signed by the governor, with not one negative vote in 3 rounds of debate or review by the legislature. And I want you all to know that I think that is because this issue became an issue all across the state of Nebraska. Every county, every city, every part of Nebraska had a concern, and they were expressing those concerns to their senators. And I believe that the issue, if it did nothing else, and we have a lot of proof that it did a lot more, it energized and made this issue a part of everyday conversation. The importance of child welfare and the protection of children, and citizens who may not have known very much about child welfare became engaged in the conversation and said, we want to do the best we can for our children. Why did this venture fail? I would have to say that I think that there are 3 major reasons why. The first is that at the beginning there was no strategic plan with any performance outcomes or very few. Nor did the state stop at any point to evaluate the initiative. And advocates, Voices for Children, Appleseed, foster care, boards across the state, CASA, kept saying, stop, stop, evaluate. Let's see what's happening. Some good things are happening in this initiative. Other things aren't going well. But at no point did anyone stop. The second reason was there is that little fiscal analysis went into it and poor financial oversight. For the lead agencies, they were given a global contract with an amount of money, not based on very much background or statistics as to whether that amount of money would work for them. They did not have a case rate. They did not have a way to actually take a look at their costs and what was happening. The third major reason, I believe, is that it did not have the judiciary nor legislative involvement from the beginning. If you look at successful efforts across the United States in child welfare reform, the legislatures and the judiciary branch has been a partner with the executive branch. On your tables or on your chairs, you have a copy of the summary of the five bills. And I'm not going to read this to you, but it would give you some idea of the major components. And the five bills were meant to be a foundation upon which we could increase our attention to the child welfare system. The state case management returned to the state, but we continued the pilot project in the Omaha area, the Nebraska Families Collaborative. And hopefully we can learn from that privatization effort some other points that we might be able to take into the future. So with that background, I'm going to have Carolyn come forward, who has been a very strong voice herself for the protection of children, and then we'll come back to your questions.
Yes, just once again, Carolyn Rooker is Executive Director of Voices for Children in Nebraska, and thank you, Senator Campbell.
I am Carolyn Rooker, Executive Director of Voices for Children in Nebraska, and I'm really excited to be talking with you today. As Senator Campbell mentioned, many of you in this room have been intimately involved in the challenges that we've faced over the years in really addressing child welfare issues in our state. I want to start out by thanking Senator Campbell and her committee for the work that they've done to provide some structure for us moving forward. The last 2 years has been so incredibly unstable for very vulnerable children and families, and the work and the structure that is created for us to be moving forward is so imperative. I think that we're all ready to look forward on what can be and start making some meaningful changes for these families. So in general, nationally, there are three main things that our child welfare system strives to do. And some of you already know this very, very well. But really what we're trying to do is achieve safety, permanency, and well-being for all of our children. All of these things are interlinked. You can't look at them separately. Many states, not just Nebraska, fall short of reaching this goal. Many of the legislative bills that have passed this past session will help us start looking at what it will take to get there. We have, from Voices for Children's perspective, two crucial problems in Nebraska. One, we have a growing number of kids who are experiencing abuse and neglect. And number two, we have an astonishing amount of children in out-of-home care. When this initiative started 2 years ago, the goal was to flip the pyramid. We had 70% of our kids in out-of-home care, 30% in in-home care. The goal was to flip that pyramid, serve more people in their homes and less in out-of-home care. But none of the base structures had been changed to allow this to happen. So, for example, you have a infographic coming around that shows federal funding and how we spend our dollars, federal dollars. Now, we wanted to do a state graph like this, but that's part of the problem. We've never really known what it takes to serve these vulnerable children and families. And all of the structures, even at the federal level, you get reimbursed if a kid is out of home. So if a kid needs help, well, let's place them out of the home so we can draw down these federal dollars. Now, that doesn't mean that you're doing that just for that. There are obviously kids who at times need to be removed for safety. But why are we second highest in the nation? Why are we removing so many kids? So if you look at that federal funding silo and you look at flipping the pyramid, we are spending most of our money on out-of-home care and very little in prevention and in-home supportive services. So to truly flip the pyramid, you would have to look at flipping the pyramid financially and developing systems within the communities statewide, not just Omaha and Lincoln, but in all the rural areas, making sure that there are supportive services in the communities so that we can start looking at supporting these families. The other thing that I think is quite interesting, if you look at the child maltreatment in Nebraska graph that I've passed around, you'll see over the last decade that the substantiated cases of child maltreatment in Nebraska have risen significantly. There's been a few times there's been a few dips, but for the most part, it's been increasing. Now, if I were to ask you how many of these cases, these substantiated cases, were for child abuse or for neglect, what would you think that answer would be? What? Neglect. Well, you guys are smarter than I am, because when I first started doing this work, I thought it would be child abuse. That's why we remove kids, right? Because their parents are beating them. Well, no, not necessarily. Now, interestingly enough, when you think about neglect and you look at poverty in our state, we've gone from 10% to 18% of children living in poverty in the last decade. That's the highest it's been in a decade. Do you think that that's a coincidence, that this is rising at the same time poverty is rising? We know that it is extremely harmful for children to be removed from the home. When I was doing frontline work, I was amazed at working with kids in foster care, how much, no matter what they had been through, that they longed and would cry and want to be with their parents. So the question is, do we take the right kids out? Are there things that we could do if we were investing more in upfront types of services? Could we actually keep some of those kids in their home with their parents who love them that might need some help? I want to give you an example of a really cool thing that you guys have probably all heard about, and that's home visitation programs. Public health nurse home visitation as a means to prevent child abuse and neglect nationally has really great results. We have one of those programs, and we have even at the state level some of that. It's not system-wide. It's not across the state. But if you can provide support for a young mom who's struggling early on during that very stressful time, we have some pilot projects that we've actually seen the data that really can actually prevent child abuse and neglect and removal from the home in cases that were very likely for that to have occurred. In fact, there are some moms who have already had one or two children removed but had public health nurse home visitation and another chance and were actually able to keep those children in their home. So if I go back to where we are now and where are we going, I think that the legislation that has been produced and created and now moving forward will really help us look at financial oversight and accountability, will really help us look at caseload standards. Again, when I was doing frontline work with families, I can't imagine having 30 to 50 families. How can you affect meaningful change with that many kids under your care? So the one of the bills where it allowed for the appropriate caseload standards so that social workers and folks who are working with these families can affect meaningful change in their lives. And I think we as a state have to really look at what are we willing to do in terms of where we spend our dollars. We need to look at how and why we're taking kids out of the home. Right now, it's when in doubt, take them out. And trust me, I am not being critical. There are many children that definitely need to be kept safe. However, what would life be like for our kids, our future Nebraskans, if we literally had some sort of response system that gave these families an option, many options for services and for help? So rather than immediately pulling the child out, they could be plugged in the services, right care at the right time, and we could maybe keep some of these families in their home and avoid some of that further trauma for them. So looking at our front door, looking at how we're utilizing intervention strategies and wraparound services for families who are in care, And I think all of this will help us move forward and bring about a better Nebraska. These kids will maybe be senators someday if we do the right thing. And, you know, we really, a quote, we always start our staff planning meeting and staff meetings with a quote, and staff now tease me about it. They're like, oh boy, I got to find my quote. Carolyn's going to kill me if I don't have a quote. And I just keep thinking, you know, if we keep searching for like the ideal and what can be, it can be inspirational. And this work is not for the faint at heart. And all of you who are out there doing the work day in and day out, you know that. But we must strive to be worthy. We must all work hard and strive to be worthy of our children. And so I'll leave you with that. And I don't know if I kept on my notes at all, but basically we want, I'm done. So if you guys have questions, I got off on my tangent.
Well, it's time for questions. And again, there is paper and pencil at your table. Please write your questions down. Somebody will come around and pick them up and bring them to me to read from the podium. But I am kind of interested in this caseworker situation to begin with. I mean, how many children is each caseworker typically in charge of? What's the optimum number? Do we need more caseworkers? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, in the bill.
Gary, that's a great question. And a statistic, am I okay there? A statistic that is in the LR37 report, which, by the way, you can access if you go to the legislature and look for the Health and Human Services Committee. Do not try to print it out on your own. It's 400 and some pages. But the first 25 are the ones that you should probably take a look at, because those are recommendations and findings. But one of the statistics that we always talk about is the fact that if a child has one case manager, person working with them in the time that they're in a placement, in home or out of home, if they have one, the chances that they will reach some sense of permanency, they will go back and stay at home, they will be with a relative, they will be adopted, is 74%. If they have two or more case managers and workers, that statistic drops to 17.4%. And if they have more than five or six, I believe the number is, it drops to 0.1%. And why Gary's question is such a good one is that because we were seeing high turnover in case managers. In fact, a Lancaster County judge last November contacted me and said, I have had four case managers in 4 weeks. And so it gives you some illustration. Now, we are trying to get to a point where, and it depends on in-home or out-of-home, Gary. So 16 families, 17 families, I'm looking around. Dave, that's probably pretty close. 17 kids.
We budget every show of 1/4.
Yeah, they're a little lower. But around that is the national. What is encouraging is that the governor suggested to the Appropriations Committee, and they adopted an infusion of $20 million to bring those case loads down and hire more case managers. That was a significant step on the part of the executive branch. I think NFC has probably been at that number all along, but it will help us across the state. Long answer to a question.
I just want to add one quick thing. The thing that's really important to note about this is that when these agencies, the private agencies, many of them were required to have the 1 to 14 case ratio or whatever, approximately that was it, but other parts of the state did not. And so not only are we getting to caseload standard sizes, which is phenomenal, but the legislation made sure that it was statewide. So everywhere, that means the department, anybody who's serving these kids has to keep at that standard, which is amazing, because now it's like urban and rural, you're still going to have that caseload size, which from a state perspective is imperative.
Help me with one thing. We talked about privatization and how we're changing from that, but there still is privatization in the state, isn't there? How is that working? What are you doing?
Absolutely. Privatization, and probably that wasn't as clear. Prior to going into this, the state has always had contracts with private agencies across the state. Before we went to the lead agency model of privatization, the state had about 150 direct contacts with agencies. We still have many of those agencies, and we would be so remiss not thanking those agencies who do the everyday direct line work for children.
So we're not moving out of privatization.
No, we're moving away from the lead agency model at this point.
Okay. Are you going to take a look at that over time? This goes to a question I've got here. It says, are there implementation guidelines and deadlines for under these new laws for the state?
Yes. Almost. If you take a look at the handout, there are deadlines in almost every one of those bills by when we have to file, by when the state has to get a Title IV, which is a federal grant that we're trying to get, which would put more money into intervention, prevention, and in-home services. Every single one of those bills have put deadlines in place and in order to be able to monitor. When you look at LB 949 from the performance audit, now the department has to meet on a quarterly basis with the Appropriations Committee, and we are monitoring that. Liz will be spending quite a bit of time reviewing all those financial reports. 1160, there's a lengthy list of reports that are all due to the Health and Human Services Committee by September 15th of this year. So we have put as tight a deadlines as we can in every bill.
And there's the possibility that you may be making changes yet. As you move into a new legislative session, you're going to take a look at this and see what's happening and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
And from Voices for Children's perspective, we really think now is where the difference can happen. All of these structures have been put in place, and it really makes a difference in terms of how we follow through with all of those things and how they're implemented and how it happens. So now the real work begins. Now we continue to work together and a partner to try to find permanent loving homes or help kids keep and stay in their own homes and help them get the support that they need up front.
Is there any explanation for why the private entities bid on these contracts for services? Seems like really bad business judgment on their part.
You want to take that or you want me to?
Well, I think to the five lead agencies' credit, I think they went into the initiative with every confidence that they could make it work. But without that financial analysis from the state to know what that base was, what was the state spending, you have to realize it'd be very difficult for that private agency to figure out. And I think it was hard for them in their defense to do it. I also think that they had the confidence that they could move more or move quicker to have kids on an in-home service than perhaps in an out-of-home, which is more costly, particularly in shelter group homes, that type of thing. And I think they thought that they could change that movement quicker, which did not happen for them.
Plus, really, in reality, they were being asked to do more with the same money, although we don't know really what the same amount was. So they were providing aftercare and that sort of thing. So I really think that all of the last 2 years speaks to the lack of planning, which Senator Campbell already talked about. And we know privatization has worked in some states, and some states it hasn't. But certainly the way we chose to implement it, it didn't work.
And we also did not phase it in. We didn't start with an area, see if that would work, and we never ran a pilot. So we never went, huh, that's what we learned from this. We just went statewide.
Made some mistakes.
We learned, but we learned from them. And that's what's important here, is that these bills reflect what we learned in order to move forward.
Is there, this is a question relating to adoption, is there a need to review adoption-related issues as a follow-on to the child welfare effort? As an adopter, the time and cost was outrageous to finish the adoption. I think this person says $13,000 for 1 year is what I'm getting here. Can you talk
about
that?
I'm not sure if we have any data on that in our Kids Count report. Do you know, Sarah? I will say that there is a challenge in terms of getting children to permanency quick enough. And if things wouldn't drag out so far, it probably wouldn't be as costly. That's my, like, really educated statistical comment on that. Excuse me. But we could certainly research some of that and see. I think that's a good point. It shouldn't take that long, and it shouldn't take that much money when you're trying to adopt a child who the whole time you're thinking about not only that, but how long it has taken for that child to achieve permanency and wonder what's happening and, you know, the instability in that child's life as well.
You know, 5 minutes in my life is probably pretty quick, but 5 minutes in a two-year-old's life, given the relative nature, that's why, you know, children, the phrase was often quoted, children don't have a shelf life. I mean, they need that attention right away. One of the bills that we just were, you know, when you think about this whole area, we couldn't cover absolutely everything, so Gary's point is well taken. I think we'll probably come back and take a look at some issues, but one of them is Colorado law. And the Colorado really does shorten the adoption period. I mean, it causes the system to look quicker at what the needs of the child and if there needs to be a termination in certain cases. And I would expect that at some point we'll take another look at the Colorado law.
Foster care was mentioned, and I'm wondering, I know, you know, it sounds like what you're trying to do is get these kids back to their families, essentially, but where that's not possible and you have to use foster care, are there enough foster care families? Are they able to do the kind of job that needs to be done for these kids? Do they get proper training? I mean, talk about that a little bit.
I think we could collectively look at each other and say, no, there are not enough families across the state. One of the bills that you will notice in your list, we are calling your first bill, LB 820, a monthly stipend for foster parents for the upcoming year. We called it a bridge payment. We added $3.10 to every day for that foster family until we can come up with a rate across the state. Nebraska is one of the lowest paying states when it comes to foster families. I think it's uneven across the state as to how well they are trained and how much support they get. Some of our private agencies, I think, do a great job supporting their foster parents. We don't have enough foster parents, short answer. Number two, we particularly need them for teenagers.
The other thing I would mention about that is really looking at the whole concept of kinship care. If we're trying to keep families connected, and if a family is struggling and they have to lose their children for a period of time, wouldn't it be awesome if we could find some loving person that's been involved in their life, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, that sort of thing, and connect them in that way so that they can at least stay in their families? We are collaborating with a group of folks, and actually Senator Campbell's speaking on that panel. I think maybe Dave is. It's next Wednesday, and Sarah's going to pass. Did you bring the? Yeah, so only a couple? Okay, well, then she's not passing those out. But if you go to our website, you can see at voicesforchildren.com, there is a kinship panel next Wednesday that will be discussing this very point and how and really that could help solve not having enough foster parents or at least finding more adding to the mix.
How much do they get paid?
Oh, it varies across the state. I mean, and it also varies as to the level of what difficulty the child may bring into their care. So it's to say an average rate. No, we really can't tell you that, Gary, but they are tiered off, and each agency may be a little bit different. What we're going to try to look at is, do we need to get to a base rate across the state? One of the foster parents testified in Grand Island and probably was an impetus for LB 820 and this bridge payment, and she was being paid $10 a day, and she had three babies in diapers and formula.
So it's obviously not enough.
Not enough. Now, that's not the norm across the state, because some of our foster parents are paid, you know, more than that on a daily basis. But that's the unevenness that we need to take a look at.
How's that decision made on how they get paid?
The department is doing a rate, and in some states, Gary, the legislature introduces legislation to set that rate or how you arrive at it, and I expect that there will be further legislation.
Do you think foster families in general take on these children because of the money or because they are the kind of people who just really see a need there and want to help?
I'm going to start, and we'll let Carolyn talk about that too, but one of the collaborators that I talked about was the state ombudsman's office, who did just yeoman's work, and they did a survey that was available to foster parents across the state about how things have progressed in this initiative. And their top number one concern was not money for themselves, but they wanted better communication with their agencies and the State Department. And number two is they wanted to be respected in their opinion. They themselves were not asking for more money. The legislature, I mean, we recognized that as we saw that. I think that tells you a lot about why people do foster care.
I would just summarize by saying foster parents are truly angels on this earth, and if they were doing it for the money, then they must not be doing the math, because it's dollars in, dollars out, and there's absolutely not enough dollars. So people who choose to become foster parents do it for very personal, passionate, philosophical reasons that they want to make a difference and support people. So I don't think anybody does it for the money. Like social workers, nobody does it for them.
I mean, and in many cases, very faith-based.
Yeah.
I mean, they believe that that's in their value system and faith.
In the areas of the state that had privatization, were there positive changes in the, is this right, CFSR body or?
Oh, the federal.
Am I saying it right?
I think the person is asking about whether there were positive changes in the federal benchmarks that we watched. The feds, one of the things that drove the, certainly that we went to a new initiative, is that we did not do well on the federal benchmarks as you look across in the area of child welfare. But then there's a lot of other states that didn't do well either. I mean, we have to be honest about that. I think that was mixed. I think you saw at times, you know, if you tracked it from beginning to end, you probably didn't see a great movement. But at periods of time, we did see improvement out of the privatization effort in the LEAD model. And I think the Children's Commission will go back and look at some of that data to say, okay, what points can we extrapolate out of that to improve the system?
And I would say for the last 2 years of instability, I mean, you think about five different companies and all the changes, it would be amazing. It's amazing, actually, that there wasn't much of a change up or down, because actually it should have been a lot more down with that much change and instability and, you know, caseworker changes and all of that. So it really is kind of interesting that it wasn't way worse given all the instability of how it was implemented.
I want to note here, I mean, we're a lot of the LEAD agencies toward that model toward the end, of course, was in the more populated part of the state of Nebraska. And there was a LEAD agency in the central, western, and northern service areas of the state. And that was the group that in August of 2010, by mutual agreement, pulled out. But what happened is they left a number of agencies that they owed money to. Now, in Lincoln and in Omaha and Douglas County, we have a number of super agencies. And so, you know, if one's not carrying this program, maybe another can step in. But when you are in Broken Bow or Pierce, Nebraska, or Ogallala, you don't have great numbers. And so what then happened is these agencies were owed this money. And they couldn't, from a business standpoint, they got to the point where they couldn't cash flow it. They used up all their resources at a number of what I call mom and pop, good small agencies in the rural parts of Nebraska went belly up or got out of the business. And so those three service areas have suffered from the fact
that they lost services, lost agencies. So they're trying to come back and reformulate that. And actually, the department put in its budget, inside that $20 million that I talked about that the governor proposed to appropriations, is a resource development person. I'm not saying that title exactly, but to try to help in those service areas to rebuild some of the agencies and services that they lost. So, you know, don't think that the rest of the state, you know, just went, they got along fine once they went back to the state. They have struggled mightily.
You know, I think I'm wrong in this, so correct me, but in reading a lot of the articles while all of this was going on, the legislation was moving through the legislature and so forth, I got the sense that it was either going to be privatization in Nebraska or not privatization. But it sounds like we're doing kind of a combination of both, and that's the way it may continue. Am I right or wrong in that?
I think the articles would have one of the major questions was whether the case management should remain in the lead agency model or whether it should return to the state. That may be what you're referring to. And the LR 37 report was very strong in its recommendation that case management should go back to the state because the state can never, ever, ever, ever contract away its responsibility for the protection of children. And so that issue then came to bear. When KVC left as a lead model and we began looking at this, the case management returned except for the pilot program that is here in Douglas County that Dave has talked about with NFC. And we are going to be watching and seeing, you know, are there some things that we can learn yet from a lead agency who still has that case management? Does that help, Gary?
Yeah.
It was never a question of whether privatized or the state, because you have to realize the services, by and large, are provided by private agencies. Does that help kind of define that for you? We probably didn't do a good enough job with that.
This, I think, is kind of connected to that. The questioner asks, how do you handle case management loads when the rate is based on families, not children? Some families have two children, some have five.
Well, it's the number of children that they have total.
It's complicated. Basically, it depends on, there's some national experts that have recommendations, and it's CWLA. I'm not one for acronyms, obviously. But there are standards that are known to affect meaningful change. And it matters on if the children are in the home or out of the home in terms of how much energy or time it takes for the caseworker to work. That's why, depending on if the child is out of home, it's a certain number, or if they're in home, it's based on child or families. And conceptually, that's probably all you really need to know about that piece, because then it gets like complicated into the details. But we don't just make this up on what makes sense or what we have money for. Maybe we have in the past, but that's not where we're at today. I mean, Senator Campbell really looked at what our best, and gosh, wouldn't it be great if in all of our child welfare stuff, we looked at national best practices on what it takes to affect meaningful change. This caseload standard recommendation, family versus kid, in-home versus out-of-home, is a national best practice recommended strategy, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And it is in LB 961. And I'm sure we'll continue to monitor that. But we did put the CWLA. We said we're going to watch and adhere to those standards. So,
we haven't talked at all about the juvenile justice system yet. And this is a question that goes right to that. Would adding more juvenile judges across Nebraska speed up, I think the word here is permanency, speed up the process whereby...
Well, it's very interesting. Depending on where you live, really depends on what kind of situation, if you're a juvenile in trouble, faces. I do happen to have an expert on that area in the audience, Sarah Forrest. Would you be willing to just stand up and speak to that issue in general, if that's okay?
You know, if you're going to talk to it, come on up here to the mic, because we've got, we got a mic over here. Why don't you go over there? Next to Bob.
The reason why I bring Sarah into this is because really when we think about child welfare, we think about the cute little kids and the younger kids. And so often we forget about those teenagers that really it's hard to find foster homes for. They're naughty. They're in trouble. And gosh, if you read their file, you'd be naughty. I mean, if you'd gone through that, you'd be naughty too. So, I mean, we really, Sarah has made this a personal passion and has really taken some leadership in this initiative at Voices for Children.
Go ahead and give us your name again.
Sure. I'm Sarah Forrest, and I'm the Policy Coordinator for Child Welfare and Juvenile Justice at Voices for Children in Nebraska. Sort of addressing the question, I think it was, does adding more juvenile court judges speed up permanency? And I think it's sort of a complicated answer, right? So if you're dealing with a kid who's out of their home, there are a lot of things that need to happen for permanency to be achieved. Court timelines is certainly part of that process, and in certain jurisdictions in Nebraska, we have a lot of challenges with that. It takes a long time to file termination of parental rights to get kids available for adoption, or, you know, you're waiting 3 or 6 months for a juvenile who's been arrested for a law violation to sort of come before the court and find out what's going to happen to them. So I think those things really do slow down the process, but it also has a lot to do with casework services being available and delivered in a timely way. So I think that's something that we certainly could look at. I would also mention that there are only 3 separate juvenile courts here in Nebraska, Douglas, Sarpy, and Lancaster counties. Everyone else in the state, the county court judge also serves as the juvenile court judge and often has to travel, and their availability is limited, so that puts an extra strain on things.
Thank you very much.
I would like to add to that in the sense that we are very fortunate in the state of Nebraska with the Chief Justice who heads the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Havokin, has a great interest in this area and has established several projects, has continued several, I should say, the Eyes of the Child Initiative teams that are across the state and the court improvement. And the chief has been an integral part of the discussions of LR 37 all the way through, and his interest and commitment. And they monitor this issue pretty closely. I would say personally, I think that in the more populous area, we might be better served by several more juvenile judges. And I would guess in the Omaha and Douglas area, particularly, that needs to be looked at, those numbers.
Why the lack of oversight in the planning process?
In the planning, you mean at the very beginning? I'm assuming that's what the questioner talks about. I think that it wasn't a part of the initial planning of it all. You know, when you put together a strategic plan and you figure out, okay, how are we going to evaluate that? What is it going to look like? If you don't start out with that strategic plan, you probably haven't put into place the evaluation. You will note in one of the bills here, and I always have difficulty about which part of where we put it, but we did call for a national evaluator to come in and take a look at the system now in order to advise the Children's Commission. So we have already put into statute an evaluation of where we are. It wasn't there at the beginning, and that was one of the major problems.
This question goes right along with that, Senator. Then it just says at the top, strategic planning. What may go wrong next? What gaps concern you the most?
What may go wrong next? You know, child welfare is a very complicated system in the sense that you have legislative involvement, judicial involvement, obviously with the courts, and with the executive branch. I would have to agree with Carolyn that one of the points that we need to go back and take a look at, well, actually two, is the beginning of the entrance, and how are reports made, how does the hotline work, how are we saying, okay, we're going to accept Andy Campbell. That's my son. I always use Andy as the example. We're going to work with Andy and his family.
You're so mean.
I know. And or, you know, we don't quite need to have Carolyn and her family in the system yet. I think we need to take a look at it. And the department is certainly, I think, starting work on that with their new structured decision making. But the beginning of the system has to be looked at. I also think the end of the system has to be looked at, and that is the kids that age out of foster care. And if you want to have sobering statistics, look at what happens to kids when they age out of the foster system. I have a large percentage of the boys, a couple of years, are back in prison or in jails, and a, what, 50%, I think it may be even higher, of the girls are within several years pregnant.
Or homeless.
Or
living
homeless.
On the streets.
And we have, this is not just a Nebraska problem, this is all across this country. Because these kids leave foster care. And I don't know about you, but I have two kids. And when they were 18, 19, 21 years old, they were still calling and saying, "Mom, Mom, I don't know what to do. I have to get insurance for it. What am I going to do?" Everybody who's had kids in this room at that age knows you got a phone call. How do they do things? These kids, in many cases, have no one to call. And they age out of the system, and they have no health care. And they age out of the system, and you have to think about it. We had a young girl in our agency, and she had been in the foster care system since she was 9. And she is now, I think, 14, 15, around that age. And if something, one small thing goes wrong, she's just, it throws her into an absolute tether because everything has been decided for her and chosen for her. We don't help them prepare. And I'm very worried about the end of the system.
Go ahead, Karen.
I just want to say that Voices for Children was founded 25 years ago. We're in our silver anniversary year. On the very premise that the systems that were created to help children often created unintended consequences and kept them in the system longer. So everything we've done for years has been looking at how are kids doing in out-of-home care and in the foster care system. What would it be like if we could look at keeping them from entering the system in the first place? So what could go wrong is that we don't really learn from any of these lessons or mistakes, and we just keep doing business as usual. We've had a crisis. For the first time ever, everyone is talking about what's going on with these kids and with the child welfare system. Gosh, what a mess. I'm at the grocery store, and people are like, "Oh, wow, what a mess." They don't know what a mess is, but they just know it's a mess. I mean, people are talking about it, and it's shined a spotlight. And now we can really get down to what really matters and make a difference and try to figure out a way to provide more meaningful upfront services for these families. But we got to be willing to invest.
You know, we are out of time, and I think that's a good note to end on here today. And our thanks to our panelists, State Senator Kathy Campbell and Carolyn Rooker of Voices for Children in Nebraska.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a presentation by Nebraska State Senator Kathy Campbell, Chairwoman of the Health and Human Services Committee of the Nebraska Unicameral, and Carolyn Rooker, Executive Director of Voices for Children in Nebraska. They addressed the topic, Child Welfare in Nebraska, Some Big Changes. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, May 17, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, June 21st at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Joe Sterita, professor in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and author of I Am a Man, Chief Standing Bear's Journey for Justice. He'll speak on the topic, Chief Standing Bear of the Ponca Indian Tribe. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.